Well, we're greatly indebted to you, Gerhard, for a profound and very moving statement. Now, our next speaker is Warren Nutter, who's professor of economics at the University of Virginia. Professor Nutter, as I'm sure all of you know, in the period before the war, wrote a book and maybe several articles on economic development in Soviet Russia, which came as quite an eye-opener to many people. He took a leave of absence from the University of Virginia to serve for a time in Washington. He was the undersecretary or assistant, I don't know which, undersecretary of defense for international affairs. He's now back in Virginia and will speak to us on, I think, more on economic development in Soviet Russia. Professor Nutter.
Thank you, Henry. I can say I certainly was under the secretary, although I was an assistant. I find myself in a little bit of an embarrassing position today because I recall the question that used to be asked to all of us and used to appear everywhere during the World War II, is this trip necessary? We used to read everywhere. And I find my position embarrassing because one of my more serious failings is excessive honesty, and in all honesty, I have to say no, this trip really isn't necessary. My appearance here today is the result of what sociologists at least used to call a cultural lag. I don't know whether they have such a thing or not anymore or recognize it. I recall that Frank Knight used to remark that once at an early age written a book called Risk, Uncertainty, and Profit, scarcely a gathering passed at which he was present and the subject of profit cropped up that he wasn't asked to say a word for or against it. And having once studied the Soviet economy, I find myself in a similar position today. Again, I have to call your attention to my honest streak and point out that when your esteemed president asked me to speak before this assembly, I told him he was crazy and that he would be better off to draw a name out of a hat because I had simply lost track of everything important in this world and certainly of intellectual life behind the Iron Curtain in my 4 years of public service that spanned, I want to hasten to add, the period in between the Pentagon Papers and Watergate. But in any event, so I thought. I thought I'd lost track, but now that I've taken a quick look at what's been going on in the Soviet Union in the way of economic thinking, I'm not so sure that there was much to miss. For example, let me start with the question, whatever happened to Professor Lieberman? And all that discussion of economic reform that was in our newspapers a decade ago. Well, the best short answer to that question is that this, too, has passed away and left very little behind it in reality or in memory. A professor that was suddenly propelled from utter obscurity into the limelight in the Soviet Union has returned whence he came, and the short-lived controversy about reform has accompanied him. Perhaps there are, however, many Westerners, certainly none in this room, who believe that the reform movement was a typical kind of academic happening of the sort that we're accustomed to. A professor has a bright idea, and one thing leads to another. He reads a paper at the December meetings of the Soviet Economic Association before a host of avid newsmen as well as scholars. He publishes a learned article in the Soviet Economic Review, which precipitates a flood of comments, replies, and rejoinders. Then he writes a column in the popular weekly Newspeak. He appears on the television program Tomorrow to answer questions of the interested layman, and so on. After all, we have Milton Friedman. Why can't they have Yevsey Lieberman? Well, we in this room are certainly more sophisticated. We know that things don't work quite that way in the Soviet Union. Turn back to mid 1962, when the seven-year plan had run out of steam and other problems were kind of piling up on for Khrushchev. Perhaps he had a premonition of economic crisis. It came, if you recall, just a year later after a massive crop failure. Perhaps he had a premonition of consequent fall from grace, which was just 2 years off. In any event, he needed something to distract attention while hopefully providing a way out that at the same time would preserve authoritarian rule and in particular his own neck, which he was much more concerned about. And his eye lit on this obscure little professor, E.G. Lieberman, at the obscure Kharkov Institute of Economic Engineers, as it's called, who had written a couple of obscure articles on industrial management in the latter half of the 50s. Now, his theses had a certain appeal to Khrushchev because their purpose was to save the system. That is, the system of centralized administrative planning. And the way that he proposed to save the system was by somehow giving plant managers greater latitude in taking care of the nitty-gritty of the minutiae of day-to-day affairs. Lieberman came to be known in the West, as you may recall, as an advocate of the profit motive. And people talked about a revival of the profit motive and the convergence and all the rest of it. But what he proposed, of course, had very little to do with the profit-seeking system as we know it. The central authorities were to determine what and how much to produce, what prices to charge, what average wages to pay, what labor norms to set, and all of the rest, while the plant managers were to be given both the incentive and leeway to find the most profitable way of fulfilling the centrally determined tasks within whatever leeway was left. Just how this was to be done never became quite clear, but the object was to relieve central planning from concern for these minutiae so that it could tighten its grip on the economy. The proposal was just the sort of conservative reformism that Khrushchev was looking for. And so the party launched a carefully planned debate in the official press and the party apparatus. The debate lasted only a few months, however, because it quickly threatened to get out of hand. And this was a very interesting phenomenon, as a matter of fact. The political authorities were certainly shaken to discover how widespread and deep-seated the sentiment for reform was among economists and how difficult it was to keep the discussion within permissible bounds. The concept of market socialism kept cropping up. It was just lying there beneath the surface. Nobody dared use the words and talk much about the market, but it was always just sort of lingering there. And there was no telling where that would lead to if it was left unchecked. And so in November, on the eve of the plenary session of the Central Committee and in the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which we mustn't forget, the debate was suddenly called to a halt, and the negative was declared the winner. After some pause and an absence of any further debate, there was some brief and intensive discussion that emerged again in 1964 when Khrushchev's fate was already sealed in any event. And the whole thing came to a formal end the next year when Kosygin, who succeeded Khrushchev as premier, simply announced that now the economy is reformed. And the set of reforms which he announced have succeeded very well for 8 years in keeping things the same, which is the usual story. Well, I mention these episodes of public discussion not to reveal Soviet economic thought, but to illustrate how little of that thought can be discerned by the outsider. What's going on in the minds of Soviet economists is only remotely related to what they pronounce in the glare of publicity, as Gerhard has so clearly indicated already. We see only the tip of an iceberg and only a tip of the tip, which they're very careful in deciding to reveal. We might know more if we could sit in on some of their professional meetings or if any proceedings were written, any candid proceedings of them, but we still wouldn't know what's going on really in their minds. You'll recall that when Khrushchev was giving his de-Stalinization speech in front of the Central Committee back in 1956, that is, he was droning on, recounting all the crimes of Stalin, a voice in the vast audience suddenly shouted out, "And where, Nikita Sergeyevich, were you when all this was going on?" And so he paused for a moment, looked away from the script, and looked out over the audience carefully. He said, "Would the person who said that please rise?" And nothing happened, of course, and so he turned back to his speech, and he said, "That's where I was." Well, there's no doubt that many Soviet economists have escaped the crippling confines of Marxist dogma without making it too obvious that they've done so. And the principal way in which they've done this is by following the mathematical route. We've had a little exposition of simple political arithmetic today. They have engaged in much more complex mathematical formulations of problems because somehow ideology gets lost in these symbols, and it isn't clear from, it seems that it's some kind of an inexorable logic that coughs up a symbol somewhere or other that we might call a marginal this or that, but what's in a name? They don't have to call it marginal this and that, so they call it a shadow price or something of this sort that will not raise ideological hackles. But the same kind of thinking process is going on. And then they begin probing through mathematical techniques the optimal properties of a system based on rational calculus. And they try to demonstrate that these optimal properties can be found without in any way challenging the principle of surplus value. You don't have to get into all of that. And hence, mathematical economics, or economic cybernetics, as the subject is called in the Soviet Union, attracts the really best talent in the realm of economic analysis, as exemplified by such people as Kantorovich and Novozhilov and Agenbegian and Fedorenko, names that we have, or at least some of us, have become rather familiar with. Well, some of these economists have been bold enough to suggest from time to time a complete overhaul of the planning system that doesn't displace planning but changes its fundamental nature. They say, well, we shouldn't have the central planners fixing the exact amounts of everything to be produced. A better thing for them to do is to determine the equilibrium prices that will achieve the optimal solutions. And then we'll leave it up to the economic units to adjust to these prices on the basis of some kind of a system of incentives and so on and so on. Well, they currently call their concept, the term is an optimally functioning socialist economy, and there's some kind of acronym that Westerners have put together for that, but it doesn't matter. This crops up, and they, as I say, once in a while begin talking in these terms, and then they meet a wall of resistance, and so they have learned, having to live in this system, how to fall back to secondary and tertiary lines of defense, and they have some very powerful ones, and the most powerful one is the efficiency of the computer. They point out, well, we do have computers, remember that, and that is a more efficient way of doing certain things than just trying to note things down on scraps of paper and pass them around. And so it's come to the point in the Soviet Union now that the question being resolved is not whether to use computers or not to use computers, but rather how far to use them. And for the time being, the head of the Gosplan has having difficulty refuting that the computer has a better memory than he has at least tossed the mathematicians a bone and said, well, it's okay, you can use the computers to store and to retrieve and analyze information, but let's not go overboard. We're not going to use it to allocate resources or fix prices. The traditional system of centralized administrative planning is to remain in force. But of course, they feel, I suppose, that they have a foot in the door. The two basic factors that restrain any real economic thought are obviously the Marxist ideology and authoritarian rule. And of the two, the Soviet leaders are much more concerned about maintaining the authoritarian rule, probably, than the ideology, if they could find some way to split the two. The specter that haunts them is the disintegration of absolute control by the party, which is in turn their source of power. And each small step toward decentralized power in the economic arena is seen as a creeping capitalism, if one might put it that way. And why take a chance? At the moment, the situation in Eastern Europe is probably foremost in their minds, and I'd like to amplify that point with some personal experience. For about a decade now, I'm getting to the point where I date things in decades instead of years, as some of you will as you get along. For about a decade, I have helped to sponsor an annual conference of economists from Eastern Europe and the West. the Russians have been invited every year for at least 10 years, but they've attended only twice. Now, the first time was in Florence in 1966, and the Soviet delegation at that time was headed by academician Gutovsky, who was a very powerful man in the economic bureaucracy. He was director and remained director until a year or two ago of the Institute of Economics at the Academy of Sciences, and he was a tough old gentleman in some ways who had survived the worst and therefore was quick with his footwork, but at the same time had been trained before the revolution in economics, and so he did know some economics that was buried back in the back of his head somewhere. He could call out once in a while when it became necessary. Well, the main event, it was a very interesting experience because he was accompanied by the normal party hacks. There's one is the spy on the other two, and then you have a real party hack who just gets up and pours out the guff, and then he proceeded to on the east they were all Kollege for the hack, and the Westerners were Gospodin. Gutovsky made it very clear in his statement. In fact, he reemphasized, went out of his way to point out that we were colleagues too, and he was very eager to become a part of the international community of scholars. As it turned out, however, this was not a very fortunate time because the main event at that conference was a spirited and running debate between a professor from Prague, a young man named Keane, who was more articulate, had more better command of language than he did of good sense, and the entire Soviet delegation, which is carried on in full view of the Italian press and continued by Keane briefly on Italian television. And Keene, joined by others who became emboldened, had absolutely no kind word to say about the Soviet system. It was lousy. There wasn't any planning at all. It was just a mess. It was just, and so on. And what they needed, he said, was market socialism, as they were going to introduce in Czechoslovakia. Well, this didn't open up the lines to the Russians at that particular time. And of course, meanwhile, back home in Czechoslovakia, this spirit was rising ever more on the scene, leading ultimately to the autumn of 1968, when the Russians concluded the debate, and very decisively. Now, after some 4 years had passed, in which the lesson of who had won the debate was being allowed to sink in, the Soviet delegation reappeared in 1972 at Ermenonville in France. By that time, Katovsky had been tossed out too from his position, and there was a new leader who was one of the new big shots in the hierarchy, economic hierarchy, unfortunately not trained in the pre-revolutionary period. But it didn't matter, because by that time the Czechs hadn't yet been able to rejoin the conference, and most of the other East European economists had revised their vocabularies significantly and had discovered that the word market didn't really exist in their languages. So the upshot was at this particular conference, all one could hear in any kind of meeting of this sort was the line. And one had to rely entirely on private conversation. Now, nothing had really happened fundamentally to the thinking of these people, and nothing had really happened fundamentally to the thinking of the Soviet economists as to the way they wanted to go. Western economic thought became contagious in Eastern Europe, and it has not been eradicated there by the use of brute force. Brute force has shut it up, but it has not eradicated the thinking. So why should the situation be really much different in the Soviet Union? There are certain factors that will lead to some differences, but they're not enormously important, in my opinion. I'm confident that Western economic ideas are spreading and intensifying inside the Soviet Union. But on the other hand, I see almost no likelihood that much is going to happen in the near future as a consequence of this. The Soviet leaders have learned very well the dilemma of the czars, as I like to put it. Like the czars, they are quite well aware that the economy is sick, maybe even dying. But also, like the SARS, they are afraid that curing the patient will kill the doctor. And that fear just will not fade away, because it is rooted in reality. And so I would conclude my hope brief remarks by saying that economic thought will prosper in the Soviet Union, but it will do so only when the totalitarian regime is shaken by some process yet to evolve. Thank you very much.